a Missoula woman dies in a house fire. Good evening, I'm Connor Valentine.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you what kind of summer fire season to expect. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with Democratic U.S. Senate candidate John Bollinger about his stand on everything from balancing the budget to building the Keystone Pipeline. Authorities say a woman died after a home caught fire outside of Missoula. The Missoula Rural Fire District responded to the fire on Mullen Road last night. Responders found bystanders trying to resuscitate a woman as light smoke poured out of the single-story home. Fire officials say responders took over medical care of the woman and an engine company extinguished the fire. 67-year-old Karen Lewis Miller was pronounced dead at a hospital. Three people were treated for minor burns and inhalation. The fire district is investigating the fire and says the initial indication is that it was caused by cigarette smoking materials.
And in other news from around the state, there are never guarantees when it comes to wildland fires, but experts convened in Missoula today to tell Governor Steve Bullock that all major indicators point to a potentially quiet fire season this year in Montana. Bullock spent some 2 hours this morning with representatives from agencies such as Forest Service, BLM, Montana Department of Disaster and Emergency Services, the Montana National Guard, and the Northern Rockies Coordination Center. NRCC meteorologist Brian Henry says fire season always fall into one of three categories. One is the so-called barn burners that consume 1 million acres or more in Montana, northern Idaho, and the Dakotas. Those happen once every 3 to 4 years. In average years, 170,000 to 240,000 acres burn. Henry says 60 to 70% of fire seasons fall into that category. And then there are slow years, during which fewer than 100,000 acres burn. Think summers of 2008, 2009, and 2010. Henry says this summer may just shape up to be one of those quiet years.
And the good thing is that there are all the other factors that we look at, like drought, anticipated temperatures and precipitation for the spring and summer months. Everything seems to be pointing towards a year that where it should be slightly less active than normal. Will we have a fire season? Of course we'll have a fire season. It's just how much it's going to burn.
The peak of Montana's fire season typically starts around the second to last to the very last week of July.
This year, with the cool and wet spring that we've been having across the area, and with the slow melting of the mountain snowpack and the abundant precip we've had over eastern Montana, we think that the start of that fire season, or at least that peak, is probably going to be pushed back into early mid-August. So that would shorten the window or the length of our fire season, which could push our acreage down.
And don't forget about the other major player in this year's anticipated weather, El Nino, or the warm ocean water temperatures that periodically develops off the Pacific coast of South America.
Going back and looking at the historical data, we see that El Nino springs can tend to be cool and slightly wetter than normal, and that's what we have been experiencing all spring long thus far. That's what we're expecting for the remainder of the month heading into early, possibly mid-June. Now, as we transition into summer, temperatures can be right around normal, and we can, though not always, a slight wet signal across southwest Montana, central Montana, and eastern Montana. The Climate Prediction Center outlooks do tend to point towards that possibility as being in play for this year. And based on the recent data I've seen, I would support that as well.
Governor Bullock says he's convinced various local, state, and federal wildland fire agencies are prepared for whatever may come our way this year. He also seemed satisfied at the level of cooperation among all the agencies, a model that was described today as receiving national admiration.
I'm also glad that we have the coordination occurring around this table to make sure that we're prepared for whatever Mother Nature might bring to us. And finally, I'd say that as part of this, and even looking beyond this fire season, we need to do what we can to make sure that our landscapes, you know, we're designating priority landscapes for a larger view of saying, how can we make sure our forests are healthy, that jobs are being created, our fisheries are protected, and that's one of the things that we're working on to try to get some additional forest management done.
State Representative Pat Cunnell sponsored the Wildland Suppression Fund in the Montana legislature that essentially changed how the state pays to suppress wildfires.
There's always budgets due to vacancies or programs that have not fully been spent towards the end of a fiscal year. And we now encourage those departments, rather than going on to a spending spree for one reason or another, those monies get reverted into the fire suppression fund. This kicked in actually last year for the first time. So fighting the Lolo fire you were listening about that cost the state darn near $12 million, we're not faced with having to pay that tab out of future tax revenues. The money was in the bank. That has already been paid for, and we still have now around $40 million, as I understand, to help cover the fires that we may see this year.
As optimistic as the professionals are about this upcoming wildfire season, meteorologist Brian Henry says nothing is written in stone. What's more, El Nino may result in drier and warmer fall and winter, which, of course, may have ramifications over the summer of 2015.
The Roman Catholic Diocese of Helena is giving notice that sex abuse victims have until August 11th to file a claim as part of the diocese's bankruptcy proceedings. The diocese filed for bankruptcy reorganization in January as part of a proposed settlement with about 360 victims of sexual abuse from the 1940s to the 1970s. Today's notice by the diocese is part of a May 6th federal court order setting a deadline by which claims must be made. Anyone who is sexually abused as an employee of the diocese or believes the diocese is liable for their abuse before the January 31st bankruptcy filing can file a claim by 4:30 p.m. August 11th. Claim forms can be obtained from the diocese, and they preserve the abuse victim's rights in the bankruptcy case.
A Republican congressman from Montana says the state's coal and mining industries would suffer under a proposal to cut carbon pollution in Washington state. U.S. Representative Steve Daines sent Washington Governor Jay Inslee a letter today asking him to reconsider his proposal. The Democratic governor in April signed an executive order to reduce Washington's greenhouse gas emissions. It includes phasing out electricity generated from coal. All three of Washington's private utilities get some of their power from Montana's Colstrip power plant. Daines says Inslee's order would have severe economic consequences for Colstrip and surrounding communities. Inslee's office did not have an immediate response. Daines, who is running for U.S. Senate, was meeting with Montana coal industry representatives in Billings.
A missing single-engine plane with two brothers in their 80s on board has been found crashed on a mountain in northwest Wyoming. The Park County Sheriff's Office says the plane was found this morning on a rugged, snowy mountain just outside Yellowstone National Park. However, the fear of an avalanche has prevented rescuers from reaching the crash site, which is at about 9,900-foot elevation, so officials can't determine the condition of the occupants. The 1963 Mooney M20C was last seen last Tuesday departing Yellowstone Regional Airport in Cody. On board were 84-year-old Robert Zimmerman of Huntsville, Alabama, and 86-year-old Ward Zimmerman of Seattle, Washington. The plane was reported missing Saturday, and the search began yesterday. The brothers were headed from Cody to Twin Falls, Idaho, and then to Seattle.
A Box Elder woman has made an agreement with prosecutors to plead guilty to assault in the death of her 11-month-old son. The Great Falls Tribune reports Cecilia Gardapie will plead guilty today. The agreement calls for a second-degree murder charge against Gardapie to be dropped. Garrett Kirby LaFrambois, the boy's father and Gardapie's boyfriend, made a similar plea deal and was sentenced to 13 years in prison in April. Cadence Small died October 21st. An autopsy found the child had multiple skull fractures, a broken nose, brain hemorrhaging, spinal hemorrhaging, and bruising across the head and torso. Prosecutors say Gardapie had been drinking when she became frustrated by the child's crying. She told authorities she covered his nose and mouth and then shook him violently for 90 seconds.
A sixth person implicated in investigation on the Rocky Boys Indian Reservation has pleaded guilty to corruption charges. The Havre Daily News reports Tammy Leishner of Laurel entered her plea Thursday in U.S. District Court to aiding and abetting embezzlement from an Indian tribal government receiving federal funds. Prosecutors say Leishner, her brother, and her father participated in a scheme to divert hundreds of thousands of dollars in federal aid meant for a water pipeline. Prosecutors say money was kicked back to former State Representative Tony Belcourt, who led the tribe's construction company and awarded the contracts. Belcourt, his wife Haley, Leishner's father, James Eastlick Sr., and her brother, James Eastlick Jr., previously pleaded guilty to corruption charges. A Box Elder businessman, Hunter Burns, also pleaded guilty.
Police say two people are in custody after an exchange of gunfire inside a Billings house left one of them wounded and prompted police to evacuate several people out of a back window. The Billings Police Department said in a statement that officers responded to a report of a man with a gun at about 11 last night on the south side of the city. The officers heard several shots inside the house and helped several people inside crawl out a back window to safety. The two unidentified suspects were taken into custody after they came out the front door. One of the suspects was transported to Billings Clinic with injuries that were not considered life-threatening.
A federal appeals court has issued a split decision upholding the government roundup of 1,600 wild horses along the Nevada-California line in 2010. In the 2-1 ruling today, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco rejected an appeal by horse advocates accusing the Bureau of Land Management of gathering too many Mustangs in violation of several laws, including the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act. Judge Carlos Bea concluded in the majority opinion the BLM completed the necessary environmental reviews for the Twin Peaks Roundup and that the court must defer to the agency's expertise. Judge Johnny Rawlinson wrote in her dissent that such deference isn't warranted if the agency interprets part of a law inconsistently with its overall purpose. She argues BLM violated the, quote, express purpose of Congress to protect the horses.
A bankruptcy judge has given conditional approval to a key report to Southern Montana Electric Generation and Transmission Cooperative's reorganization plans. U.S. bankruptcy judge Ralph Kircher on Friday approved the wholesaler's discount statement, pending minor technical changes. The report details its business operations, bankruptcy filing, and reorganization plan. The Great Falls Tribune reports Kircher tentatively set a June 2nd hearing in Billings in which the reorganization plan could be confirmed. Southern is proposing to repay creditors a reduced debt of $21 million over 4 years while keeping customer electric rates at current levels. Southern has been in bankruptcy proceedings for nearly 2.5 years since completing construction of the Highwood Generating Station with $85 million it borrowed. Southern provides electricity to cooperatives in Red Lodge, Lewiston, Hysham, and Ashland.
Leaders of an American Indian tribe in Montana awaiting federal recognition say they are closer than ever to that goal. The Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians Council Chairman Gerald Gray spoke with Governor Steve Bullock last week. Gray says recently proposed rule changes for recognizing American Indian tribes would put a nod from the U.S. government within their reach. Federal officials say the proposed rule changes are in the midst of a months-long finalization process. The landless tribe has been recognized by the state of Montana since 2000. With about 4,500 members loosely centered in Great Falls, federal recognition could bring the tribe land along with housing and education assistance. Gray, Bullock, and others met as part of the annual Tribal Leaders Summit at the state capitol in Helena.
Former Republican state legislator and Lieutenant Governor John Bollinger wants to be Montana's next Democratic U.S. Senator. Bollinger is an ex-Marine and former Billings businessman who served 5 terms in the legislature and 2 terms as the Republican Lieutenant Governor with Democratic Governor Brian Schweitzer. He's pro-choice, pro-gay rights, and now proudly wears the label of progressive Democrat. He's running against banker-turned-rancher Dirk Adams and Senator John Walsh in the Democratic U.S. Senate primary. In this feature interview, Bollinger talks issues with news director Sally Mock, including why he supported passage of the Affordable Care Act.
Because it provided an expansion of Medicaid. $7 billion was made available for that purpose. And the Montana legislature had a chance to expand Medicaid because of the Affordable Care Act passing. It would have provided health care to 70,000 low-income Montanans. It would have provided an additional opportunity to employ 12,000 people in the medical field. I think it was a great failing of the last session of our legislature. So I'm pleased that the Affordable Care Act provided this opportunity. I was disappointed that the Montana legislature did not buy into it.
Of course, the argument why they didn't buy into it was that it was going to eventually cost the state too much money, that even though the federal government was going to pay most of it for the first few years, that eventually it was going to fall to the state to pick up a lot of that expense and that would be something the state couldn't afford. That was the argument.
I know, but the argument does not hold water. Sally, even when the state had to pick up its share That was only 10% of the total cost.
Still millions of dollars, though.
90% would be paid for by the federal government.
But it's still that 10% would be millions of dollars.
Exactly. And when Brian and I left office, when the Schweitzer-Bollinger administration left office, we passed off nearly $500 million in an ending fund balance. There's sufficient money.
But you would, if you had your druthers, prefer a universal health care?
Yes, I would,
single
Sally.
Pair.
What I think that the Affordable Care Act is a good first start. Good first start in the sense that it did bring us the opportunity to expand Medicaid. It did give us the opportunity to do away with pre-existing conditions, which has been a real stumbling block for a lot of people. And it allowed young people to stay on their parents' insurance program until they're 26 years of age. Those are all very positive things. It, as I say, is a good first start, but I'm anxious to see us move to a single-payer system.
The cost of health care is one reason cited for the country having the sort of financial woes it has. And certainly balancing the budget is a big issue in Congress and has been for years and will be for many more, I'm sure. How would you balance the budget? The House Republicans would like to balance it by cutting taxes and cutting some services like Medicaid.
Sally, I think that they're wrong in their approach. Frankly, I like the Simpson-Bowles proposal in that it requires not only increased revenue but also a decrease in spending. When Brian Schweitzer and I became our governor and lieutenant governor, we were successful in that we came from small business backgrounds. We challenged expenses. We developed our resources. We created opportunity for more employment than our state has ever seen. We were successful because of our ability to manage a budget. And I think that the federal budget has to be managed also. I think sequestration was a horrible, horrible idea.
But what would you cut?
Well, I think this takes study. I can't just say, oh, well, we need to cut this, this, and this. But I will say this, Sally. Nearly 70% of our budget is spent in the military. I'm sure that there's fraud, waste, and abuse somewhere in that huge military budget. I think that, and that's not to say I'm not for a strong defense. I mean, I'm a Marine Corps veteran. I understand the importance of our military. But I think that the role of our military should be one to, protect our country. But I don't think that we should consider ourselves the world's police force anymore. I think we're members of the United Nations, members of NATO. We have treaty obligations to uphold, but do so in a proportional way. We don't have to be the only people that commit troops or money, whether it's for humanitarian purposes or whether it's for maintaining world peace. I think that we can reel in some of that role that the military has assumed, and let's rebuild America, let's restore the middle class. We have a crumbling infrastructure. It's time to for a public investment in building the infrastructure, whether it's a highway system or a bridge system, a water system or a sewer system, or let's expand passenger rail service.
I want to talk now
yes,
about
ma'am.
Some key environmental issues. You support the Keystone Pipeline.
Yes, I do.
You also think climate change is an issue?
Indeed it is. It's not just a natural phenomenon that is coming and going. No, we as human beings are the contributors to global change, the principal contributors, and we must come to terms with that. We must create more wind, solar, hydropower. But getting to the question of the Keystone XL pipeline. Let me say this about it. Firstly, we we have to look at the Keystone XL pipeline as a positive thing for Montana for several reasons. The first of which is that it will create tens of thousands of good-paying jobs during the construction period.
Not in Montana. Not that many in Montana.
Well, during the construction period, it will.
Tens of thousands.
Well, it'll create a lot of good-paying jobs. I'll rephrase that, because it will extend from the Canadian border down to Texas. There'll be a lot of people put to work. But what it will do for Montana is create jobs, and that's always a focus of any administration. It will help us become independent of Mideast oil, and I think that should be a stated preference. I would only support the Keystone XL pipeline with several provisions. One, that whatever oil is put in that pipeline has to be consumed in the United States of America.
Because the oil companies have not agreed to that. They don't want to agree to that stipulation.
If I'm a member of the United States Senate, that would be a stipulation I would place upon it.
What would you say to the environmentalists who say, if you believe climate change is a problem, you can't support Keystone because it continues on the same spiral that we're on, which is encouraging more development of fossil fuels?
Well, Sally, the day will come when we can plug in our cars, when we can no longer rely on petroleum or coal as energy sources. But that day has not yet come. The other thing that I like about the Keystone XL pipeline is that it is a much safer way to transport oil than by rail or by truck. And I think that it's safer. And over all this, overreaching it all, is this wonderful constitution of the state of Montana that calls for a clean and healthful environment. Now, we charge the Department of Environmental Quality to enforce this wonderful constitutional provision. And so we should say, okay, DEQ, you have the responsibility to make sure that pipeline does not leak oil in Montana.
I want to get to the campaign right now.
Yes.
And you have said that you would only serve, if elected, one term.
Yes, ma'am.
And if you did, you'd be, I think, 84 at the end of that term, right?
Yeah, I'm experienced, Sally. And believe me, experience matters. I've had 20 years of public policy making. As a legislator, I served three terms in our House, elected two terms to our Senate, two terms as our lieutenant governor. I am the only one of the candidates that has introduced legislation that has become law, some of which is the most progressive our state has seen. I think experience matters. Trust me.
Seniority also matters in Congress. It's maybe a sad truth, but it's a truth that you really can't get anything done until you've been there a while. How could you accomplish anything with no seniority?
Sally, did it take Elizabeth Warren seniority to get so much good things done in her first term, which, she's a newly elected senator from Massachusetts? I'm going to spend 100% of my time representing the people of the state of Montana. I'm not going to spend half my time raising money for my next election. I think money has a corrupting influence on public policy. There's not a member of Congress that doesn't have to make a deal with political action committees and these lobbyists that finance their campaigns. I'm not going to sell myself out. I'm going to be your 100% full-time U.S. senator, not a half-time guy, not just working 3 days a week. And I'm blessed with good health, lots of energy, and I tried retirement once, Sally. I was fortunate. I made some good investments, and I was able to retire when I was 56. I had a shelf full of books that needed to be read. I read those, took the trips I wanted to take, caught a few fish, hit a few tennis balls, hit a few golf balls, and decided there's more to life than this. I have a passion for public policy as it relates to the common good, and it's my hope that the people of Montana will give me that opportunity.
Well, I have been speaking with John Bollinger, who is a candidate for the U.S. Senate on the Democratic ticket. Mr. Bollinger, thank you so much. Pleasure.
Thank you, Sally. I really appreciate visiting with you.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight, look for mostly clear skies with lows in the mid-20s to lower 30s. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies with highs in the 60s. In central Montana tonight, it should be partly cloudy with lows in the 30s. Tomorrow, we expect mostly cloudy skies with highs 55 to 65. In southwest Montana tonight, look for mostly clear skies with lows in the 20s. And tomorrow, it should be partly cloudy with highs in the 50s. And now for the editorial comments of Bruce Farley.
The most recent report from the International Panel on Climate Change indicates that the greenhouse gases continue to accumulate in the atmosphere at an alarming rate, with concentrations the highest they have been in at least 800,000 years. The thousands of international scientists comprising the panel warn that resulting global warming will severely reduce sea ice and continental ice masses, producing rising sea levels, dramatic changes in ocean alkalinity, and modifications of the dominant ocean currents that produce weather. Last week's release of the U.S. National Climate Assessment, a peer-reviewed document produced by some 300 highly credentialed U.S. scientists, reports that indeed some of the effects of the greenhouse gas-induced climate shift are no longer avoidable. Indeed, some impacts are already here, manifested in the increased frequency of flooding, wildfires, and severe weather events that the nation has experienced in recent years. In the West, a rapidly changing climate means getting used to more fire, friendlier conditions for invasive species, and most profoundly, erratic water supplies. Scientists agree that even if we reduced all human-produced greenhouse gas emissions today, current concentrations are still high enough to ensure the warming trajectory will continue for decades. And therefore, besides tackling the priority task of reducing carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, largely by severely reducing fossil fuel use, society should also seek ways to buffer the effects of climate disruption that can't be put back into the bottle. Though the federal and most state governments have generally failed to significantly deal with carbon emissions, some tools are readily available to reduce the impacts of climate change, especially the long-term trend we are seeing with smaller western snowpacks, this year in Montana notwithstanding, and increased drought and reduced stream flows. The simplest tool is at hand. Doing everything we can to protect and restore the natural function of western watersheds, especially our high basins, as well as the natural form and function of streams, floodplains, and wetlands. Last month, the United States Environmental Protection Agency released some common sense draft rules that will reinstate protective measures for some of the most valuable but least appreciated waters in the nation. The tens of thousands of stream miles in our mountains, valleys, and prairies that are intermittent in nature. The rules clarify that developers and land managers must seek permits and approval under the Federal Clean Water Act before they dredge, fill, or otherwise damage intermittent streams and wetlands deemed, in legal lexicon, waters of the United States. These rules simply reinstate the permitting landscape that existed before U.S. Supreme Court rulings in 2001 and 2006 created confusion as to what constituted a water meriting protection under the Clean Water Act. This legal confusion generally results in no protection. The court rulings also eliminated protection for ecologically important isolated wetlands such as prairie potholes because a majority of justices, rather than evaluating how science informs good law, decided that science was immaterial and so the nation must have bad law. After years of study, the EPA has now crafted protective rules that are consistent with the confusing rulings affecting intermittent streams, though conservation of isolated wetlands is still in limbo. Because a stream doesn't run year-round, or it includes reaches that for geological reasons occasionally run dry, doesn't mean it has no value for downstream communities, agriculture, or aquatic species. In Montana and elsewhere in the Mountain West, intermittent streams are the capillaries that deliver high-elevation snowmelt and spring rains to our rivers. Their beds and banks store water for late season flows, capturing water from winter snow and metering out delivery of critical groundwater that helps recharge lower elevation streams. This benefits many Montana communities whose domestic water source is derived from upper elevation watersheds. It benefits irrigators, the majority of whom tap surface or groundwater flows born in mountains. Intermittent streams, which comprise more than 60% of all stream miles in the nation, are hugely important for sustaining aquatic ecosystems and critical to most of Montana's native fish species. Some of Montana's cutthroat trout populations, including in the Blackfoot River watershed or in the Upper Missouri River region, use intermittent streams for spawning. Many prairie species in eastern Montana are 100% dependent on stream courses that run dry seasonally. They survive during dry periods in disconnected pools, then migrate during rainy periods. Investing in protection and restoration of Montana's large network of intermittent and even ephemeral streams is essential for buffering the impacts of a changing climate. These waters are simply capital we can ill afford to squander. This is Bruce Farling of Montana Trout Unlimited. Contact us at www.montanatu.org.
Bruce Farling is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening.